Hello, Capital Region. This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Livonia Mallory. I'm still on my couch, but my other half is in the studio.
And I'm Guy Schaefer in the studio for the first time in a year and a half, and I could not be happier. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we've got a great show for you. First, Mark Dunley gives you an overview of the recently concluded 2021 legislative session with a focus on climate change, single-payer health care, and criminal justice reforms. Then on Reclaiming History, Livonia Mallory interviews Egyptologist Dr. Solange Ashby, author of Calling Out to ISIS, The Enduring Nubian Presence at Philae. After that, Phil Smart brings us coverage of the Albany mayoral debate, in which incumbent Kathy Sheehan faced off against the Reverend Valerie Faust and Republican candidate Alicia Purdy. Then HMM's Corinne Carey speaks with Marquita Edwards, who is running to represent District 6 on Troy's City Council. And to close out the show, Moses Nagel takes a trip to his local library and speaks with Deanna DiCarlo and Lauren Cardinal, a few of the librarians who have kept the library going through the pandemic. But first, here are the headlines.
The Times Union reports that with most faculty and students vaccinated, colleges and universities in the capital region are easing COVID-19 restrictions for the summer. Union College no longer requires masks outdoors regardless of vaccination status or distance between people. Indoors, Union students may gather in small groups without masks. At RPI, biweekly testing for on-campus students and staff has dropped to weekly. Vaccinated individuals may remove masks outdoors, and coverings are still required indoors. All RPI students and employees in certain job categories must be vaccinated by this summer.
The Palace Theater in Albany recently became one of 10 arts venues across New York State to receive financial assistance from the $16 billion federal Shuttered Venue Operators grants to help venues impacted by the pandemic.
Hudson Valley Community College is offering an added incentive for students seeking to earn college credits this summer. Free textbooks for courses beginning in July. In May, Hudson Valley announced plans to offer more than 50 college-level summer courses for high school juniors and seniors at no cost.
Children under age 12 could no longer be arrested as juveniles under a bill that passed the New York State Legislature. The present rule allows the arrest of children 7 or over. Criminal justice advocacy groups criticize the Democratic-led legislature, which wields a veto-proof supermajority, for failing to pass more bills to help people denied parole, as well as New Yorkers with criminal records. Lawmakers failed to pass an expected compromise bill to automatically seal the records of many criminal convictions at least 3 years from sentencing for a misdemeanor or 7 years for a felony. The Assembly also didn't pass Thursday a bill to direct the state parole board to start evaluating whether individual prisoners over the age 55 would pose a significant public safety risk if released. And that's it for the headlines.
Mark Dunley gives an overview in our upcoming episode. Mark Dunley gives an overview of recently concluded 2021 legislative session with a focus on climate change, single-payer health care, and criminal justice reform. There are short interviews with Ariel Swernoff of New York Renewals on the Climate and Community Investment Act, with Corinne Carey of Compassion and Care on the New York Compassion and Care on the New York Medical Aid in Dying Act.
The 2021 New York State legislative session ended early on Friday morning, June 10th, with a whimper rather than a bang, as two last-minute deals on the New York City subway system and criminal justice reform fell apart. Climate, healthcare, and criminal justice advocates were disappointed by the lack of action on many key bills, though the overall number of bills that were passed did increase after last year's COVID shutdown. In recent decades, the lack of action was blamed on the two major parties having divided control over the governorship and the state legislature. However, this year, the Democrats were not only in charge of the governor's office, but they had a supermajority in both houses of the legislature, meaning they could override any veto by the governor. Progressives were expecting to see action on a number of key priorities, after they had won a series of upsets in recent elections. Plus, with the governor facing multiple investigations on sexual harassment, mishandling of the COVID crisis in nursing homes, and a $5 million book deal on COVID, and with many officials calling on him to resign or be impeached, the legislature was in an unusually strong negotiating position with the second floor. However, many key issues failed to pass, often failing to move even out of committee. A number of major proposals on climate change failed to move. Some criminal justice reforms passed, but less than expected, including failing to make it easier for inmates over 55 to be released. The Clean Slate Bill would have sealed the records of those who had been incarcerated after a certain period of time. Advocates argue this would help these individuals secure employment and find housing. The proposal to have New York join other states in giving residents the right to seek medical assistance in dying failed. Legislative leaders seem to have lost interest in big picture items once the state budget was passed, which did include several notable reforms, including marijuana legalization, full funding of education 15 years after the courts first ordered it, and a significant increase in taxes on the wealthy, though far short of what advocates had been pushing. As the governor fled Albany to avoid media questions about his troubles, he said that the only thing he was interested in having done was having his appointments to the Court of Appeals and the Public Service Commission approved, both of which he accomplished. One factor in the relative lack of action on key issues was that even as COVID restrictions began to be eased statewide, lawmakers and the governor refused to reopen the Capitol to the public. Many advocates complain about their inability to directly lobby and protest legislators, saying that Zoom calls were a poor substitute to exercise pressure. Single-payer health care, which had previously passed the Assembly repeatedly, was not even voted on in the Senate, despite having a majority of senators as sponsors. The lead Assembly sponsor, Richard Godfrey, chair of the Health Committee, publicly complained that bill sponsors were lobbying against the bill behind closed doors. Low-income workers were dismayed that once again the sweat bill to address the massive problem of wage theft failed to pass. The bill had been approved by the legislature several years ago after many years of organizing, only to have the governor veto it on New Year's Day. While Governor Cuomo had said that he supported the purpose of the bill, he wanted to propose several amendments, but in fact, no action was taken. For the second year in a row, the state legislature failed to take action on climate change. One ready-made excuse was that they wanted to wait until the 3.5-year planning process initiated under the CLCPA climate law was finished at the end of 2022. The legislature evaded addressing the growing call to expand public power in New York State to give residents more control over the state energy system. Various proposals to halt new fossil fuel infrastructure were shelved, though a committee of the State Climate Action Council did call for a partial moratorium. A bill to address the rapidly growing carbon footprint of cryptocurrency, which is heavily dependent upon computer use, failed to move. The legislature on the last day did vote to approve three new members to the State Public Service Commission. The PSC is a powerful state body that sets utility rates and oversees overall energy decisions for the state. In fact, has more impact than the state legislature. Two of the appointees put forth by the governor were seen as weak on energy issues and were viewed largely as being yes men for Cuomo. The legislature also approved a bill that advocates worry will enable cement plants in the state to more easily burn materials, waste materials such as tires. One of the biggest issues was the Climate and Community Investment Act, a carbon tax penalty by the New York Renews Coalition, which led the community effort to enact the CLCPA. We're joined by Ariel Swernoff, who is the communications and digital organizer for New York Renews, a sort of broad-based environmental justice, community, labor coalition, works on a lot of climate issues. Climate was definitely one of the things missing from the end of the session this year, but particularly a lot of people had help that was called the CCIA, sort of a polluter penalty for carbon, would be enacted. So, Ariel, maybe we start off, you know, why was the CCIA important and why wasn't it enacted this year?
Sure thing. Thanks for asking. So 2 years ago in 2019, the New York State Legislature passed the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, which was a modified version of a bill that the New York Renews Coalition had been pushing called the Climate and Community Protection Act. The CLCPA, New York's climate law, sets out mandates that New York State has to meet in terms of reducing our reliance on fossil fuels, investing in renewable infrastructure, and investing in frontline communities, communities of color, and working class poor communities that are hit worst and first by pollution and the climate crisis. So we passed those mandates 2 years ago, but we need to fund them. And that's what the CCIA does, the Climate and Community Investment Act. It puts a penalty on corporate polluters, on the toxic emissions that they're putting into our air, and uses that money to meet our climate goals, to invest in creating good green jobs, to invest in communities hit hardest by the climate crisis, in public transportation, in building efficiency, in fossil workers who will be impacted by this transition. So it's a really critical piece of legislation. We got close this year, but ultimately lawmakers failed to bring it to the floor for a vote.
Another key issue was the New York Medical Aid in Dying Act. We're talking with Corinne Carey, who is the senior campaign director for Compassion and Choices in New York. And unfortunately, one of the bills that failed to pass at the end of the legislative session was the New York Medical Aid in Dying Act. Corinne, can you tell us quickly why that bill was important and why did it not pass this year?
Sure, Mark. Thank you so much. So as many of our listeners may know, New York's Medical Aid in Dying Act would have given terminally ill adults with less than 6 months or to live, would have given them the ability to say to their doctors, look, if you can't cure me and you can't relieve my suffering, please allow me to get a prescription for medication that I can take at a time of my choosing to bring about a peaceful death. And the reason that this bill is so important is that there are some people for whom even the best hospice and palliative care do not relieve their suffering. You know, there are certain types of cancers, certain types of neurodegenerative diseases where you're on pain medication for a very long time and it stops working. Where your suffering for so many other reasons is so great that you want to be able to have some autonomy over what your last few days look like. Gather your family, say goodbye, and drift peacefully off to sleep and have a peaceful death. That's why this bill is so important. And every single year that the legislature fails to pick up this bill and pass it, more people suffer.
The legislature now goes home for the rest of the year, though there is some possibility that the assembly may have to come back to deal with the impeachment process it has started with respect to Governor Cuomo. Hudson Mohawk Magazine will run the full interviews with Compassion and Choice and New York Renews next week. This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That was Mark Dunley with an overview of the recently conducted 2021 legislative session. Next, on this episode of Reclaiming History, Lavonia Mallory interviews Dr. Solange Ashby. Dr. Ashby is the first African-American Egyptologist in the discipline's 221 years of history. Her first book, entitled Calling Out to Isis, The Enduring Nubian Presence at Philae, explores the Temple of Philae's history as a Nubian sacred site. This is part one of a multi-part series of interviews.
And why is the study of Egypt so important in understanding ancient history in general?
Yeah, because for me, I know it, and I think for so many Africans in the diaspora, it pushes back against this white supremacist fallacy that there was no history in Africa.
Once again, welcome to another segment of Reclaiming History.
The excerpts you just heard are from my upcoming interview with Dr. Solange Ashby. Stay tuned. Dr. Solange Ashby received her PhD in Egyptology with a specialization in ancient Egyptian language and Nubian religion from the University of Chicago. Dr. Ashby's expertise in sacred ancient languages, including Egyptian hieroglyphs, Demonic and Coptic, Ethiopic, Biblical Greek, and Biblical Hebrew, underpins her research into the history of religious transformation in Northeast Africa and the Middle East. Her first book is Calling Out to ISIS, The Enduring Nubian Presence at Philae, and that's what we'll be talking about later. She is also a founding member of the William Leo Hansberry Society. You can find out more about the William Leo Hansberry Society by visiting hansberrysoc.org.
So I am so excited to have you on the show. And so I'm just thrilled that we have you in the discipline to bring a different perspective. Egyptology, you know, you are an Egyptologist. You are I've got to make sure I say this right. I always say Nubiologist, but I don't know if that's the correct.
That is correct.
Nubiologist and an archaeologist. I mean, you're sort of like the female Black Indiana Jones.
Wow. Well, thank you. I have to say, let me just qualify. I cannot claim the title of archaeologist. I did go along on an archaeological excavation in Sudan, but really I was there to observe the professionals at work and then to see if they pulled anything with text out of the ground, because I really am a text-focused person. And that is sort of a divide in the field. Either you're digging up artifacts or you're reading and interpreting ancient texts that are either on them or on, you know, papyri or temple walls, that kind of thing.
For my listeners, Egyptology as a discipline has been around since what, the early 1800s?
Yes. Maybe even late 18th century, Champollion was making a crack at figuring out how to read the hieroglyphs. I think that was 1799, but really then the early 19th century is when the discipline took off.
Not too far after America established themselves as a free country, free of Britain, 1776, you have 1796 or so, 20 years later, we have this new discipline that is just starting. And from 1796 approximately until the current day, you are the first African-American female Egyptologist.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
That's unbelievable.
Yes. Yes.
And so why is besides the fact that it's taken what? How many hundred years is that, doctor? I don't even know. I can't.
too many.
Your accomplishment, what you've done as the first African-American female Egyptologist, it's groundbreaking. You are a trailblazer. You are the one on which the hopes of so many people who have studied Egyptian culture for so many years from the outside, like myself.
Yes.
There was no one else that we could call. We could say, listen, explain this to me, because so much of the language is in French. The translations are in French. They're in German. And those languages are not available to the average person.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, and that's academic gatekeeping going on there. I should say that, and I'm sure that you are aware that there have been African Americans for at least 100 years who have made a very serious study of Nile Valley civilizations And we just founded an organization to try to bring more African Americans into this discipline. And we've named our organization after William Leo Hansberry, who was doing this already in 1922 at Howard University. Excuse me, got his degree at Harvard, studied at University of Chicago. That's my alma mater. But he was never able to claim the PhD designation of Egyptologist, although he was infinitely well educated in the field. And so it has just been a history of exclusion of our people from these academic disciplines that, as you know yourself, being a student of this civilization, that doesn't mean that we were not studying this civilization. It just means that it took that much longer for any of us to earn a PhD in the discipline.
Mm-hmm. And why is the study of Egypt so important in understanding ancient history in general?
Yeah, because for me, I know it, and I think for so many Africans in the diaspora, it pushes back against this white supremacist fallacy that there was no history in Africa. So if you have only Europeans who are serving as Egyptologists, who are those professionals who can interpret the ancient language and culture, they get to make up a narrative wherein it was the great white race that came and began this amazing civilization somehow or other on the African continent. So that's James Henry Breasted from the University of Chicago, where I studied. And so, but that is simply not true. This is an ancient African civilization. And the fact that it is one of the very oldest and most spectacular already makes clear the lie that there was no history in Africa. And I want to add that, you know, Egypt is not the only place that amazing history has been occurring and continues to occur on the African continent.
So, Doctor, are you saying that the Egyptians did not look like Elizabeth Taylor?
Yes, I am. I'm definitely saying that they are and have always been African people. And that phenotype of Elizabeth Taylor with the pale skin and the blue eyes, if it ever did appear in Egypt, would not have shown up until the Macedonian Greeks got there. And I tend to think of them as being more of a swarthy European look with brown hair and brown eyes. So yes, less likely to be an Elizabeth Taylor look. Certainly not in the foundational periods of the Old Kingdom, that phase when the Giza pyramids were built, or the Middle Kingdom, that classic phase when most of the amazing ancient Egyptian literature was written. That was all African. And it was not until later periods when Egypt started being conquered by outside forces, the Persians, the Assyrians, then the Greeks and the Romans, that we start getting a more diverse population of people moving into this incredibly rich area along the Nile.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to another segment of Reclaiming History. I have a very special guest on the line.
Dr. Shalange Ashby, Egyptologist. She just published her first book,
Calling Out to ISIS, The Enduring Nubian Presence at Philae. It's published by Gorgias Press.
There's a special discount code created for Reclaiming History listeners. It's Nubia, spelled N-U-B-I-A. Get a 30% discount by visiting GorgiasPress.callingouttoISIS at www.GorgiasPress. That's G-O-R-G-I-A-S Press. Remember, that discount code is Nubia, spelled N-U-B-I-A. Thank you, Dr. Ashby, for joining us this evening.
Thank you, too. Nice talking with you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
I love doing that. She is the founding member of William Leo Hansberry Society. Visit HansberrySoc.org to find out more details. And remember, there is a 30% discount for our Reclaiming History listeners, just use the code Nubia and tune in again for the continuation of my discussion with Dr. Solange Ashby. Love that lady. Oh, am I going again? And for those of you just tuning in, if you're still listening, I'm still Livonia Mallory, and I'm on my couch, and Guy.
And I will remain Guy Shaver until further notice, and I am in the studio. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOC LP 105.3 FM in Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM in Schenectady, WOOA LP 106.9 FM in Albany, and WCAA LP 107.3 FM in Albany, coming from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. Our mission is to use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from Sanctuary sustainers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, that's hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call us at 518-272-2390, that's 518-272-2390. Albany's mayoral race has two women facing each other on primary ballots June 22nd, in addition to the city's usual array of write-in candidacies. Incumbent Kathy Sheehan and the Reverend Valerie Faust recently faced off in a virtual Meet the Candidate event to demonstrate their different approaches and summarize the raison d'etre of their candidacies. Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Paul Smart edited down the nearly two-hour debate, which included Republican candidate Alicia Purdy, to get at some key differences.
There are two candidates running in the Democratic primary for mayor of Albany to be held June 22nd, incumbent Kathy Sheehan seeking her third four-year term, and the Reverend Valerie Faust of Living Word Tabernacle, who ran as a write-in candidate in 2009 and 2013. We pulled audio here from a recent Meet the Candidates event sponsored by the Council of Albany Neighborhood Associations and NAACP, organized by the League of Women Voters and moderated by Susan Arbetter. The tape included Republican candidate Alicia Purdy, whose statements we have not included here.
Earlier today, we raised the Pride flags at City Hall. Happy Pride Month, everyone. And after that event, I had a conversation with a community leader who shared with me a number of losses that she's experienced just over the last 6 months. And as we discussed those in person, I realized that this is someone who, in the ordinary course of a year, I would see dozens of times. But because of the COVID pandemic, I hadn't been in the same room with her in over a year. And so for many of us, the experiences that we've had over this past year have been made all the more worse because we haven't had access to many of the support systems that we've come to rely on. The pandemic has impacted our relationships, our trusted institutions like our churches and our schools. It's also laid bare the undeniable impacts of structural racism on our community and on our country. And it can make people feel hopeless and helpless. But as we come out of this once in a century pandemic, there is much reason to hope. First of all, social justice and equity have now become the cornerstone of building back better. And thanks to the American Rescue Plan, which I lobbied and fought very hard for, we have unprecedented resources available to us to help our families, our businesses, and our community. And as we reopen, we have the opportunity to re-engage with one another and listen to one another as we reimagine our city moving forward. And so I look forward to hearing the questions tonight, talking about my track record and building on my experience, building on my servant leadership, my commitment to equity, and my proven track record as we lead forward over these next 4 years.
I'm pleased to be here tonight, and I thank you guys for putting it on. I'm glad to be here with the other candidates, and I am running because I felt that there was a need for a change in the city. I felt that the city was feeling very sad. We were under heavy pressure of depression and and loneliness and a whole lot of negative emotions that just permeated the city, the whole city. And I felt that a change needed to come, that people needed to be brought together. So one of the reasons why I am running is because I want to be a bridge builder. I see that this city is so divided and so scattered. And I think that relationships have to be rebuilt, relationships between the community and the policemen, the people in City Hall, just across the board, employees with employers. So I am in the race to try to bring a change, wanting to bring a change to the city and to do something different. We need new ideas. We need innovation. We need another direction. Albany is the capital city and of the greatest state in the world. And we need to bring this city back up and bring more people back to the city who wanting to come back to the city, to get safety in the city, to get a budget that's community built that will help the people in the community. So I'm in the race to bring changes. We need change. That's my mantra. We need change. It's time for change. And that's what I want to do with the people of this city.
Questions pulled from audience members focus greatly on recent gun violence that has plagued the city these last 3 years.
We do have unprecedented gun violence happening in our community and in communities across the country, and we do have to do something about the proliferation of illegal guns that is plaguing communities here in Albany, and as I said, all across the country. We know what works with respect to engaging the community. We know that the GBI program that we have in the city of Albany, where we focus on people who are at risk of either using a gun or being a victim of gun crime, we know that those programs work. We also know that when we focus on the programs that we have in the city, our incredibly successful summer youth employment program, the West Hill Community Center that we're engaging in, bringing community back together, that also works. And we also know that there are many, many unmet needs that are out there in the community. And so we have to take a different view. Yes, we want to ensure that we have law enforcement on our streets, but we also need to ensure that we're looking creatively at what it really means to do outreach in the city. And that outreach doesn't have to be necessarily by a beat officer. And so we're working with community-based organizations to create community outreach workers who will work within our community, connecting people to the rich services, the rich programming that we do have in this city. But far too many people are still disconnected from that, aren't aware of it, aren't aware of the opportunities that exist.
It's not getting better. So some of the things that I would like to do to try to, with the community, to slow that, get these guns out of the hands of our perpetrators. Number one, the gun buyback didn't work. SNUG wasn't working. Some other programs wasn't working. You have to get to the youth. You have to get to the families to talk. We have to have the community together, the police, the politicians, the churches, because when you talk about somebody's issue and you don't include them in it, it's like trying to fix them without their input. So we need to bring people in who are experiencing these crimes, bring people in who are doing these crimes, and bring our youth into better programs that work.
There was also a request for comments about the city's attempt to address police reform.
I don't think it has been very successful because I don't think it's been transparent enough. A lot of people still don't know about it. I think that it is following a lot of the same steps and thinking processes of old. And so I think we need it and we should do it. But I think that we need fresh minds, fresh ideas. We need to rethink things that we have been going over before. We just need newness. And when you're trying to put, there's something that says you can't put new wine in old wineskins because it'll bust. You can't put old information out to solve new problems that are worse and that are not getting better. So yeah, I'm for it, but I think that it should be restructured.
Well, I'm really proud of the volunteers who stepped forward, participated in 64 meetings. We held 14 hours of public comment. But I also understand why people don't believe it was transparent enough. We were in the height of a pandemic. We weren't able to get in a room together and have these conversations. And so we are going to be engaging the public. We're going to be going out to parks, going out to community organizations and meetings, informing people about what's in the plan, getting more input. We have 27 action items that are in that plan. We need to hear from the community about how they want to prioritize those items, what they want to see happen. And I'm also really proud of the fact that we had police officers participate in every single working group. I was roundly criticized for that. There were activists who didn't want there to be police officers at the table. But you can't reform healthcare without nurses. You can't reform education without teachers. And you can't reform policing without talking to the people who are doing the job. The men and women of our police department have done amazing work over these past 14 months. The stress and the trauma and all that they have had to deal with is something that has led to, I think, a real change in how we see one another. And I hope that we can get back to a place where we see one another as human beings who are trying to help our community.
In addition to addressing a number of other issues, Mayor Sheehan spoke about the history of systemic racism and how it's affected trust for government and policing this past year. The Reverend Faust countered by noting that deeper conversation is needed.
In order to get a change between the Black community and policemen, there has to be communication. It has to be a bringing together. And each side has to be open and willing to start on a new foot, to start anew, fresh again.
A full viewing of the Meet the Candidate event is available on CANA's Facebook page. This has been Paul Smart for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That was Paul Smart's coverage of the Albany mayoral debate featuring incumbent Kathy Sheehan with candidates Reverend Valerie Faust and Alicia Purdy.
Marquita Edwards is running to represent District 6 on Troy City Council. She's challenging the candidate endorsed by the Democrats, Cheryl Kennedy, in the primary election on June 22nd. Edwards spoke with HMM correspondent Corinne Carey about why she chose to run for this seat, the experiences that led her to become a community leader, and the issues that she hopes to tackle should she win the seat. Early voting in this election starts on Saturday, June 12th.
Marquita, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell me why you decided to run for this position?
Well, I wanted to run for city council because I want to see opportunities in our communities that provide pathways to prosperity for all of our neighbors. I carry a purpose from my mother and my grandmother, and they've instilled values in me. My personal struggles that I've went through raising my children, trying to pay my rent, trying to feed my family, it's all been just a struggle. And being in this city that I call my home as a mother and a grandmother now, I want to see those opportunities be available for all of our communities and provide pathways to prosperity for all of our neighbors. I know through hard work and commitment, building in our neighbors and our neighborhoods, together we can realize our dreams, safe housing, nutritious food, supportive programming for our youth together. We can do better. There's so many of our children that are struggling over the last year with this pandemic. The things that we've gone through, the violence, the uprisings, and the police brutality alone, those items alone, I can't see myself not running for city council.
What life experiences have you had that make you qualified for this position?
I'm originally from Buffalo, New York, and I moved out here and I found myself homeless. I lived in Washington Park in Albany for 2 weeks on a park bench. That right there showed me that there's no way that a person with a college degree and has worked at numerous banks had to find themselves sleeping on a park bench. That led me to also being in a shelter for 2 months, living in that shelter, having services that did not provide for me, services that were supposed to be there as safety nets to uplift me. They only brought me down further mentally and emotionally and financially. So I found myself in an even deeper hole. I was grateful to say that I found organizing and became a leader and started speaking out about the injustices of the systems and the safety nets that we hold so dear and think that they're helping us when they are only hindering our people.
Markita, tell me a little bit about how becoming an organizer lifted you out of that situation.
Being an organizer, I attended meetings about criminal justice reform, parole reform with Catal Justice Center.
Can you tell me about Catal?
Catal Center for Health, Equity, and Justice. They are an organization that works on strengthening policies, people, and institutions. They work on ending mass incarceration and criminalization. The number one focus was also ending the war on drugs. We have too many people in Black and brown communities that are harmed every day by the injustice of the criminal system. And we struggle with trying to find ways out of these systems. Catal has come in and given a light to a lot of the problems, such as parole, bail reform. Working at Catal as a member and a leader with them, it was one of the most eye-opening experiences of my life, seeing that not only was I harmed by the system, but the people around me are constantly being harmed every day, even the children. I began to speak out, doing meetings with members, and going from a member and a leader to a statewide organizer with the organization. I realized, as being a statewide organizer, yes, I was making change throughout New York State, but it was necessary for me to make change local. As we always say, all politics are local politics, and I had to get down to the local source. Bail reform was one of the biggest campaigns that I worked on. Being able to say that I was a part of getting bail reform passed was a major achievement in my career. And I also worked on their parole reform bill, Less is More New York. Less is More New York is actually in the movement to hopefully pass soon. If that passes, that will change the parole system itself. Parole hasn't been touched since it's been created. That's unheard of, that there's a system in our government that has not been changed, altered, or affected in any source to actually help the people.
What did the bail reform legislation do?
So many of our Black and brown communities, and not just Black and brown, but people all over the state alone, who may be harmed and may be hurt by just saying that they can't pay a simple fine or fee to be able to get out of jail. Okay, you go to jail, you do your crime. But a lot of people that are behind these bars may not have done that crime, and they're being charged money that they had to work hard just like everybody else for in order to be able to get out. That is one thing that was unacceptable and why we fought so hard for bail and why we are still fighting to make sure that it is not put back into place.
You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm speaking with Markita Edwards. Markita is a candidate for Troy City Council in District 6. Tell me about District 6.
Well, for me, District 6 is one of the most diverse districts. I'm a person who likes to take on challenges. Seeing that District 6 is separated into basically two different zones, where we've got the uphill and the downhill, I feel it's necessary to bring us all together. There's times where, you know, we've been separated for this last year. We need to come together. It's time for us all to come together, and I think it's necessary. If nothing else, District 6, it should be the example of what coming together looks like. Let's bring uphill and downhill together and all be one district.
Markita, if you win the seat, what are some of the first things that you'll do when you take office?
One of the first things I want to do when I take office is we need to crack down on the slumlords. I live in the city of Troy. I rent just like most people in the city of Troy rent. And I know how much it affects you by having a slumlord. I've been victimized by having a slumlord. I've had to vacate my property due to rats, due to the housing falling. That's crazy. There's no way that the city shouldn't be doing things about these items, that we're sitting here allowing the landlords to continue to own property, to be behind on their taxes and not get the property up to code, so that way the residents and the citizens of Troy can actually live comfortably.
After the murder of George Floyd last summer by former police officer Derek Chauvin, Governor Andrew Cuomo charged localities across the state with looking at their own police forces and working with community members to come up with reform plans. Troy's Police Reform and Reinvention Collaborative released a plan on April 1st that received a lot of criticism. And the first action taken under that plan was to hire 6 new police officers. Some argue that the many millions that will go into these new hires just in the next couple of years could have made our city safer by investing in youth and poverty programs. Where do you stand on the report and the first action taken under it?
Well, let me say first and foremost, that report definitely made my stomach turn. As a mother and a grandmother, it's disgusting that we don't take into consideration our children and the safety of them. Police do not fix systems. They do not fix communities. Police and jails do not help us in any way, especially when they're only locking us up. And we need to come to a standpoint where we're training our officers to be human, not to shoot first and ask questions later. We need to train our officers to look at our children the same way they would look at their children. We need to make sure that these officers understand that they are here to do a job where they need to know the community that they're in. We don't have harm reduction systems in place. We could prevent a lot of the violence against our youth from officers. We can prevent the violence against adults from officers. We can prevent the violence against the mentally unable individuals from officers, because a lot of times we don't realize that people that are being hurt, that are being harmed by officers, may have a mental issue. They may be going through something at that moment, but the officers are trying to react. And when they react and they think it's a violent situation, they are reacting based upon that. I always say, because I've got people in my family that are officers as well, that they're doing a job that they are just not prepared to do. It's sad that we are placing them and expecting them to do a job that they're not trained to do.
Do you think that there's racism in Troy's police department?
I believe there's racism everywhere. I don't believe Troy's police department is immune to that, as I'm sure any police department in this state or nation is. We have to be able to fine-tune and weave out the bad apples, because this is a job where you can't have bad apples.
When you're not out knocking on doors and campaigning, where can we find you relaxing and having fun in the area?
That's a good question. These days, I don't find myself having so much fun. But if you do find me having fun, I would say definitely be down by the river. I could say, me, myself, I try to relax and find as much peace and quiet as possible. And when I do, by the water is the most serene place I can find. So definitely, you can find me at the riverfront.
That was HMM Corinne Carey speaking with community leader Marquita Edwards, candidate for the Troy City Council for District 6.
And to close out the show, we visit Albany Public Library, which has recently reopened all its branches to the public. Even as the pandemic forced branches to close over the past year, the library continued to serve the community. Moses Nagel took a trip to his local branch and spoke to Deanna DiCarlo and Lauren Cardinal, a few of the librarians that have kept the library going through it all.
Dad, let's go look. Come on.
Where?
Going to the kids' book.
Okay.
Me and my 5-year-old son loved the library. Since he was really little, we've spent a lot of time in the children's area of the Pine Hills branch of the Albany Public Library, reading, coloring, and playing with other kids. Children's librarians greet him by name when he arrives. When the library closed in March 2020, it was one of many closures that had a big impact on us. This wasn't his first time back, but one of the first. For him, being in the library and looking through books is really the point of the library. For me, though, during quarantine, I finally figured out how to order books through my online account, and I worked through a long list of novels. To find out more about how our librarians continued to serve our community during the uncertainty and upheaval of the pandemic, I spoke with Deanna DiCarlo, head of branches for the library's West Service Area.
I'll never forget the day we closed. We heard that the Albany City School District was closing, and that was kind of our benchmark for making a decision to close our facilities. None of us in the leadership team had ever really used Google Meet or Zoom or any of those platforms before, but we all kind of hopped onto a Google Hangout to try to figure out what to do. We immediately taped up all the book drops, and my boss, who's the executive director, Scott Jarzombek, worked with our board to come up with a safety plan that we have been updating every single month since last March of 2020. We had to make a lot of decisions about how to make materials safely available to the public, even though we really didn't know enough about the virus and how it was transmitted at that point. All of that stuff was, you know, kind of evolved between March and July. And we, you know, we met regularly. We all worked every single day. A lot of people joke and say they, you know, had household projects and stuff during the shutdown. Not us. We worked every single day trying to figure all this out for us. You know, our team, we have 130 employees spread across 7 locations throughout the city.
She explained how they provided more services as they found safe ways to do so.
In July, though, when it became clear that we could, you know, come back to work and figure out ways to make our materials available, we opened up for curbside service for the first time ever in the history of this organization, as far as I know. I've been here since 2006. And figuring out those logistics was very similar to the way our local restaurants had to figure it out. You know, we had to work with the city to create some extra parking over on New Scotland Avenue for that branch. This branch opened up a little bit later in August or September for curbside. We had to figure out protocols. We had to work with the Upper Hudson Library System because, as you know, as a library user, we share a catalog with them. And there's all kinds of things deep in the database for how we manage who has what and how materials get from point A to point B. And then once we kind of got that under our belt, I'd say right around September, we began opening up for appointment services. So folks could come in and use a computer, they could print, fax, copy. So that started happening, I would say, last fall. And we've kind of just recently, in the last couple of months, opened up for browsing. Folks can come in, like we're sitting here right now in this beautiful space, and we're slowly rolling out all the furniture, as you can see, you know, try to get things as back to normal as possible. We have regular hours at most of our locations at this point now, too.
Yeah.
Lauren Cardinal, the Pine Hills branch manager, described some behind-the-scenes work they had to do to be able to provide virtual services.
Between when we closed and when we reopened the buildings for curbside, we were basically providing virtual services. So people could call or email us with reference questions. A lot of it was like downloading books because our downloadable collections were still working.
I see.
And so people who had never downloaded a book now were like, well, this is all I can do. I can't get in the library. So walking people through that, even like, what's the weather? We have one guy who calls and asks what the weather is,
okay,
which is very nice. They're asking for phone numbers and things like that. And the other thing that was really labor intensive was doing virtual programming. Like the children's librarians recorded story times. And that was a huge process getting that organized and teaching people who are not maybe the most tech savvy, like how to set up, you know, the ring lights and the iPads and the, you know, it's a whole different skill set. We had someone doing the editing and we post them on YouTube. Those were really popular.
Yeah.
When everything else was shut down.
Lauren explained the steps they had to take to get to curbside service.
There was a time in between where we were coming in the building and still doing all this virtual programming and virtual services, but we weren't offering any in-person services. And that was a weird time because we were just in this empty, which is kind of nice. It's like being in the museum at night sort of thing. So it was kind of eerie. And then we started doing curbside. But when that took off, it took off. We were doing like 250 a week, which is like 50 a day. So if someone comes in the library and they like pull a book off the shelf and they bring it down and they check it out, that's it. It's like one interaction. But when you're doing curbside, the person calls and they places their holds, and then you get their holds, and then you check out their, and then they call again to make the appointment, and then you prepare it for pickup, and then you bring it out to them. So it's really like 3 or 4 interactions to accomplish just the same simple thing. So you think like, all right, well, 50 people picked up their books today. You don't really think of it. It's like, okay, that's fine. But when you think like you had to touch each of those books and talk to that person like 3 or 4 times to just accomplish that one thing, it was crazy. It was nuts. Some of the branches were just like, you know, little factories running things out constantly. But it was fun. Like we felt, you know, when you're doing virtual stuff, we're still doing something, but it's less immediate, like seeing people and and seeing the books go out and come back and talking to people was really nice.
As the word spread last month that the library was open for in-person browsing, people started to come back.
I would say at this branch, it was a trickle. I think the word of mouth was a little slower, but we're starting to get busier now. At Bach on New Scotland Avenue, it was busy from the get-go. That is a heavy children and families circulating branch, so a lot of parents came in looking for materials for their kids on the regular. It's also a very walkable neighborhood branch. I think the same is true for our other walkable neighborhood branches, like the one down on the south end. Our Howe branch has seen a lot of traffic coming in already, same with Arbor Hill. You know, things are starting to, I wouldn't call it a trickle, but it wasn't exactly a deluge either, but we're getting there.
Lauren says the interactions are what make it great to be back.
Every time we add a new service, like, so when we started doing curbside or when we started opening the buildings back up, like, people are so happy and come in and are like, I'm so excited. Like, when we started curbside, I'm so excited. I haven't had a book in like 6 months, and they were so happy. And then when we open the buildings and they come in, like, I haven't been in a library in 2 years and this is so amazing. And it's really, really nice.
And Deanna says that moving ahead, they hope to restore more and more of the services that the library provided.
We're going to make our meeting rooms available again for small public meetings. So if the Pine Hills Neighborhood Association wants to use the meeting room again, we can do that with, you know, with a cap on how many people can be in there at one time. We are also going to be making our study rooms available again. I would say, I think that's July 1st is a rollout for that, in a limited capacity as well. And we're going to be beginning indoor programming again if the numbers stay the way they are in August. So that'll be something for us to look forward to. We've had some outdoor programs, like we had a chalk drawing program here last week for kids, but we're really looking forward to being able to have folks come back in and enjoy some of our, you know, our regularly scheduled programs.
The Albany Public Library continues to require that masks be worn at all branches by staff and patrons. I asked Deanna about this decision.
We serve people from birth till end of life, so a lot of kids can't get vaccinated. So when kids come in, we want everybody to feel comfortable in the libraries. And then there are a lot of folks, for whatever reason, can't be vaccinated. So we wanted to make sure that the library remained a safe and inclusive place for everyone. So for us, it's made sense to keep the mask mandate. And we're going to reassess that at every board meeting moving forward. And the board is actually meeting tomorrow night, so I know it's on the agenda for tomorrow as well. I anticipate we'll keep it for this at least this next month.
Lauren and Deanna both emphasized how happy they were to have the library back in full swing. And so are me and my son.
No, I think what I liked was the same thing I always liked, which was just developing the relationships with our regulars. We have people who come in every single day. We say hi to them every day, and we know about their lives, and we know what they're doing. And those people are coming back, and we get to see them again. So that's really nice.
Thank you for this opportunity, and just everybody come on back to the library. We can't wait to see you here. We've missed everyone so much.
We got another walk in the pocket, so we already have one.
Yeah.
From the library. Look what's on sale.
Oh.
They put it here.
Yeah.
Didn't it mean it's on sale?
It just meant they thought other kids might like it.
Reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, this is Moses Nagel.
That was Moses Nagel speaking with Deanna DiCarlo and Lauren Cardinal. Hey, Guy, guess what?
Is it that time again, Livonia?
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm still Livonia Mallory.
And I've remained Guy Schaefer throughout the entire show, and our engineer is Sina Bazila Hickey. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice, produced by the community and for the community, and is supported by independent donations. Thank you to all of our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. And if you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m.
Tune in every weekday from 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org, through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast, and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.